listening to Harrismith Radio. Hey there, I'm your host, Wayne McPhail. This episode is about the five H's. First, there's the H in healthing.com, a website that amplifies the voices of those living with diseases and disorders and who are looking for options for healthy lifestyles. The next of the five are the four H's in the 4-H Club of Canada. So, five H's, six if you count Harrismith, which we do. By the way, if you want to read Harrismith magazine instead of listen to it, you can subscribe to the print version online at harrismithmag.com. And you can find Harrismith magazine on selected newsstands across Canada. But for now, settle in for the next half hour of Harrismith Radio. Lisa Mercado is the executive producer of Healthing.com, and that relatively new website is partnering with Harrismith to share evidence-based health and wellness information with our readers, while Harrismith shares content about healthy lifestyling with Healthing.com. Lisa herself knows all about the desire to live well. She lives with a rare form of blood cancer, a disease that caused her to set aside her life as a financial journalist and head up a unique site that amplifies the voices of those living with diseases and disorders. I talked with Lisa about her plans for the site and its healthy relationship with Harrismith. Hey Lisa, thanks for joining us. I wanted to start off by making it clear to listeners there's a really interesting relationship between your website Healthing and Harrismith. Can you talk a little bit about what the nature of that relationship is like?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been a longtime subscriber of Harrismith, and as a journalist, really interested in the whole idea behind sustainable living and the environment and basically wellness, health and wellness, and using your environment to maintain your health. And so when I started at Healthing, I thought, wow, like that would be a really cool partnership, you know? So while we're doing the medical science-y side of being healthy and navigating your health, that we support Harrismith content in terms of that whole environmental sustainable living wellness part as well. And so on Healthing, we feature regularly Harrismith stories that have to do with things like healthy drinking or sustainable living in terms of what to plant in order to maintain your health and nutritious vegetables and fruits. And so and we've managed to come together in a really cool way. We've gotten a lot of great feedback from readers how, Harrismith's content really provides a bit of a break from all the medical stuff, but also just insights into what people are doing to maintain their health other than, you know, what comes in a bottle.
Great. Okay. Thanks for explaining that. Now, I also need you to explain what the hell is Healthing? Like, Healthing isn't a word. How did the site get to be called Healthing?
It totally isn't a word. I know. Hopefully we're starting something. Originally, it started off as a bit of a play on the other term, adulting. We wanted to really focus on how health isn't a passive thing. So Healthing sounds like an action word. You know, we've gotten a lot of letters from people saying, it's not a verb. But actually, if you think about it, especially in these times, it's super, super important for people to advocate for their health as opposed to being a passenger. So we stuck with Healthing. Basically, our mission is to give people, Canadians, the information and education that they need to do exactly that. So to take an active role in taking care of themselves, looking after their loved ones, and maintaining, really strong, empowered relationships with their healthcare providers.
Right. Well, I really like the idea, the term you use, of that somebody isn't a passenger in terms of their health. And so let's talk a little more about the idea of this sort of volitional healthcare, of taking charge and taking responsibility for your own health, as opposed to putting it into the hands of somebody in a white lab coat.
Mm-hmm. That's actually something that's very near and dear to my heart. About 12 years ago, I was diagnosed with a rare blood cancer that is treated to this day with daily medication. And I really learned firsthand how important it is to take control of your health, but in a way that's, helpful and proactive. It's very difficult, as anyone will tell you, dealing with, a medical professional in terms of challenging them, in a positive way. So, what we try to do at Healthing is to, allow people to be educated enough so they can go in and and ask some really good questions, some tough questions of their healthcare providers. And that's not to say that, we're being confrontational or controversial, but it really does, we know for sure, studies have shown that health outcomes are much more positive when the patient and caregivers are actively involved in asking questions and sharing information and feeling comfortable with communicating with their healthcare provider.
So how do you square the circle of it? I mean, when I talk to healthcare professionals, and I'm sure you hear it as well, that the last thing they want is some patient coming in, you know, with sheets of paper referring to Dr. Google. Like that's sort of their hell day when that happens. So how do you buffer that, and how do you manage that so it's you're not just being annoying, seeming to know everything, and at the same time taking charge of your own health?
So I would actually shift that the focus of that question actually more over to the healthcare provider, because I would think that, sure, from a healthcare provider's perspective, sure, it's annoying if someone comes in and says, you know, hey, I, you know, read this on the internet, this is what I think I have, or, you know, you're not giving me the right medication because this is what Google says. But I think the flip side of that is, and this is really, really important for, you know, for people who provide care, is that, you know, if you're not listening to your patients, most of them are going and going to do their own thing anyways, and or they're going to believe what's on Google. So really the onus, I believe, has shifted to healthcare professionals and doctors and nurses to listen to that information, maybe open-minded about it, and it's, you know, and play a critical role in pointing patients in the right direction. So, you know, explaining why the medication they've chosen is the, you know, is a good fit for them, and explaining why the information that they're bringing is wrong or, you know, or not quite accurate. So I think that people in general will go ahead and do what they think is right, despite what their healthcare provider says.
So let's talk about patients who do what they think is right and how Healthing deals with that. Because, you know, I'm thinking back a while back, there was a lot of anti-vaccine activity in the U.S. and in Canada. A lot of people who were looking on the internet and thinking that vaccines cause autism, all sorts of nonsense like that. So on Healthing, how do you balance people's desire to take charge of their own healthcare, but at the same time, folks who are finding stuff that really isn't helpful?
Yes. So that's always a challenge, you know, with anything involving people in general, right? I mean, everyone's going to have a different perspective. And we do, you know, we do get a lot of pushback on some of our pieces that have to do with vaccines or even alternative health, you know, vitamins. I mean, there are people who just dance to a different drum. I mean, from our perspective, the way we deal with that is we just continue to provide wholesome information, right? So not necessarily shedding opinions necessarily, I would say, but we're hopefully providing enough information and education and anecdotes. I mean, one of the things that one of a big part of our mission is to amplify the patient voice. And, you know, we're hoping that when people read about, you know, the average person, like someone who's just like them, who's experienced something in health, we're hoping that maybe we're changing some perspectives by doing that.
So when you talk about anecdotes, are we talking about anecdotal evidence as opposed to scientific evidence, or how are you terming anecdote?
Great question. So actually, I mean patients who talk about their experiences, you know, and their stories. And so using people who are actually living with, it could be a certain illness or a condition, or maybe they're caring for somebody, or you know, maybe they've had an experience, for example. I mean, you brought up anti-vaccine. I mean, what if we, you know, we could feature somebody who perhaps had a negative experience by not having a vaccine. You know, the other side of that is sometimes we just let the story play out by itself. So if there's someone who's, you know, an anti-vaxxer, for example, we would let them tell their story. And then often we can either sort of present the alternative argument with data or just let other readers do the commenting. Sometimes that helps too.
Right. So how do you, again, I'm trying, I mean, you're in a very, I think, a very difficult position as a journalist, as a website that's in the public, to wrestle with these, this sort of nexus, the sort of friction point between the healthcare system and the general public. So how do you act as an amplifier for the public and for individuals fighting for their own medical treatment and not be an activist for that same group?
That's a really good question. I would say that we don't try to separate those two things necessarily. I do think that information is very, very powerful, but what's even more important is that lived experience, and you know, that's very powerful. So, you know, I'm hoping that by giving people the time and the space to talk about you know, their lives and their lived experience, their experiences with healthcare providers and health, that we are in fact doing that. We're advocating, but not, you know, outwardly, right? We're helping other people do the advocating for themselves and then also for other people in their communities.
Right. So I want to go back to the idea of lived experience and talk about your lived experience, because you're a journalist. You're in your past, you were a financial journalist for Rogers and then did some freelance. So that's a big shift from going from finance to healthcare. So was there sort of the experience of having cancer and living with cancer, was that a sort of a light on the road to Damascus moment for you? Or tell me a bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it sounds so cliche, right? Because when people, you know, have a scary experience, they often say, oh, it changed my life, or, you know, forced me to reconsider, you know, my future path. And it really did. And actually, for me, the way it came about was I was so afraid of dying. Like, I couldn't get it out of my head that I'd be living with cancer. You know, I mean, cancer is something that, you know, people consider as a death sentence. And for many people it is, although more, you know, as more research is being done and we're learning more about it, a surprising amount of people live with cancer. And I just, for my own health, my own mental health, I was a mom with young kids at the time. And all I could think about was I was going to, you know, leave them without a mom. And just, I could not move forward. And so part of my journey, I don't really like calling it a journey, but part of my experience, I guess, was, you know, starting to learn everything that I could. It's not only about cancer, but I was actually more interested in the psychology behind living with a life-threatening disease. And then as I started to do that, I realized, oh my gosh, like there's so much here. There's, you know, the idea of working with your healthcare professional. How do you get them to understand what it's like to live, you know, to live with a scary disease, and then also talking to other people who also shared my experience. And both those things gave me a sense of, I don't want to say control, but gave me some really deep insights into resiliency. You know, what is it that, you know, makes someone who has terminal cancer, for example, be able to get up in the morning? You know, how do you look forward? How do those people look forward? And then also from a knowledge point of view, writing about this stuff has really helped me feel like, yeah, I'm actually a little bit more empowered, and I can ask those good questions of my doctors, and, you know, and I feel a little bit, you know, a little less powerless, I guess. And so that really was the key thing that made me kind of step away from financial journalism. And I have to tell you, like, health journalism, way more exciting.
Well, I'm not going to argue with you about that for sure. So you didn't come to healthing directly from finance. Tell me about the rest of the trip from your illness to where you are now.
So I moved away from financial writing and got into health writing. And at the same time, I started a nonprofit group called the Canadian CML Network. And the type of leukemia that I have is actually a rare form of blood cancer that at the time when I'm diagnosed, there wasn't another patient group. There weren't many resources. Even the clinicians that I spoke to, because it was so rare, you know, they basically would Google my disease, you know, and I just thought, wow, this is so bad. And so I founded a nonprofit. You know, there are only 5,000 people with CML in Canada, so it's a very small group. But I spent almost a decade, you know, working with people who were diagnosed and their families, and we would have conferences and meet regularly to sort of talk about the uncertainty of living with cancer and how everybody is faring. You know, I'm very fortunate over the last 12 years or so, my medication has been very effective, but occasionally medication stops working and it doesn't work for everyone. And so we do have people in our group who go on to have stem cell transplants, which is another big deal. So I did that for many years. I still do it. It's actually what I call my other job. And then when Post Media started talking about launching a health, sort of an advocacy website, I thought, oh my gosh, this is such a great opportunity. It's one of the challenges that I have as a patient advocate is it's very difficult to get the patient voice out into the mainstream press. Very easy, you know, within all of these little disease communities that exist out there. But unless, you know, there's something awful happening in a disease, we very rarely hear about it in the big, you know, from the big media outlets. And so I thought this would be a great way to start, you know, a larger and a more general conversation with, you know, just Canadians in general about what it's like to live with illness. Because eventually, you know, there are very many of us will have some sort of health experience, whether or not it's ourselves personally or it's with a loved one or a child. And so I think that these are all issues that we should be talking about on a mainstream, in the mainstream, as opposed to just keeping them isolated in these little silos.
So let's talk about the conversation you're having with the general public on the site and within Post Media. And it's interesting to me that Post Media has spun this off as a separate site, as folding it into, say, the National Post or Post Media in general. And I'd like to talk a bit about mm-hmm. that, but also the idea of a conversation with the public. You're a relatively young site. What kind of feedback are you getting from the general public so far?
Mm-hmm. Well, I thought for a minute there you're going to tell me I'm very young, because I am. No, I'm just kidding.
I'll say that too, if you want. You're very young, and you have a very young
okay,
website.
Thank you for that. No one has said that to me in many, many years. Yes, we are a young site. I think what, you know, the most interesting and really exciting thing for me anyway has been about the site is that we're starting these conversations with people. Like, people actually do take the time to send an email on a daily basis. Like, we hear from readers all the time who basically say things like, it's so nice to hear about other people's experiences, for example, and not in a negative light. You know, it's nice to talk about disease and illness, but in a empowering sort of way, not in a victim sort of way. You know, we do have a lot of readers who share their own health challenges. You know, maybe they have a question. You know, I just had one actually on the weekend. We do a newsletter. We just started the weekend newsletter, and you know, she wrote in and she just basically said, you know, I save all your newsletters to share with my kids, you know, at dinner time. Like, it's those sorts of things that is a really, really big deal. So I think that we've hit a nerve for sure among Canadians that this is definitely something that they need and they want.
So when you talk about people getting a newsletter and responding via email, I'm guessing your mm-hmm. demographics skews older, despite the fact that you're young yourself.
Yeah, you're actually, that's a good point. And yes, generally, our demographic generally is over 45, so that's not really that, you know, that old, I guess. I wouldn't really, you know, put those people in the old bracket. But we do have younger than 45, but generally, yes, our demographic does skew to, you know, people who are raising children at the same time as caring for aging parents. I would say that that's probably the largest demographic.
And are you skewing more female than male? I mean, that's typical of health sites,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we are.
So it seems like you've really tried to carve out a niche of the sort of amplification of patient voice and this idea of encouraging volitional health care and taking charge of your own health care. Do you think that's the niche that Post Media wanted to see you fill?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I think that the idea is to structure. So we have a health journalist, like we have health writers who write about the newsy, you know, like really, really newsy current kind of news.
Yep.
And that's covered. We do as well on health things, but we really do delve more into like the emotional psychology of living, you know, healthy and having an illness. So yes, I do. I do think that we do feel niche that's not covered, not only by Post Media or The Post, but also other, you know, other media outlets. Right. Like really, we are the only site in Canada that has the ability to cover trending news. Like every day, you know, you can check our site and know the five top stories in the press that day. But we also have, you know, fresh content and original content and patient voices. And, you know, those three things are really our advantage.
Right. So we talked about patients and patients' voices. What has been the reaction from the medical professional community to the site?
So we've heard really good things. I mean, one of the advantages of amplifying the patient's voice is that it gives healthcare professionals some real insights into what their patients are thinking and believing. You know, you talked about people going in with Dr. Google. And that's another reason why, you know, to keep conversations open, because it's really important, I believe, if you're going to provide the right healthcare, you kind of need to know what the people you're caring for, what they truly believe, you know, despite what you're telling them. So, you know, we've heard, you know, we've done, for example, we have done experience stories. So What It Feels Like is a new series that that we're working on, and where we interview a person living with something. And we get at the dynamics of the disease and the science of the disease, but we also get at what is, you know, for example, one of the questions is, what is the most inappropriate thing someone has ever said to you, you know, regarding your condition? And one of them was pulmonary hypertension. And we were talking to the I'm not going to call her a patient, I'm going to call her, you know, a person living with pulmonary hypertension, and, you know, talking about a tube that she has in her chest. And so we were, you know, just going through, like, is that painful? How do you wear a bikini, for example? Do your kids wonder what that is? And, you know, and we did have feedback from a few medical professionals who said, oh my gosh, I had never, like, I didn't think about the whole bikini thing, you know, like, apparently the bandage is huge. Is there a way to make the bandage smaller? You know, those sorts of questions that a patient, you know, who's often very lucky to be alive, you know, wouldn't think about, you know, you wouldn't think of asking your healthcare professional, hey, do you think you can trim this bandage a little bit so it looks better and, you know, with my bikini?
Right.
But, you know, these doctors are reading these stories and thinking to themselves, oh, you know, I hadn't even thought of that.
Right. Well, it sounds like you've got a really healthy relationship with healthcare professionals, certainly a healthy relationship with the audience that you're aiming for, folks that are living with disorders and diseases. And it's great to see that you also have a healthy relationship with Harrismith. So thanks for explaining a bit more about the site and about the relationship, and good luck with it in the future.
That's great. Thank you, Wayne. Thanks for having me.
That was Lisa Mercado, living well in Toronto. Stephanie Nagelsmith is the chair of the Canadian 4-H Foundation and is on the board of 4-H Canada. She's also an avid 4-H'er herself. 4-H is like the Madonna or the Lady Gaga of youth clubs. It has rural roots, but it's reinvented itself over the decades, but it's kept some of its core principles intact. I chatted with Stephanie about those changes and what's remained the same. Here's our conversation. Stephanie, thanks very much for joining us. When I was young, 4-H was very much an agricultural club and a very rural club. And I think its roots came from trying to encourage, you know, back at the turn of the 19th century, young folks to encourage their fathers and mothers to adopt some of the new agricultural practices. But when I look at the 4-H website and annual report and magazine, it feels like 4-H has dramatically morphed and changes from province to province, country to country, decade to decade. Can you talk a little bit about how you hold on to your roots and at the same time adapt to the changes in geography and generations?
I think you've hit the nail right on the head. When we look at how 4-H looks today and how the youth programming at 4-H is today, it is a clear reflection of the generation we're serving today. Generation Z has different interests. They see the world through a different lens, just like the millennials or the baby boomers or Generation X would have experienced and seen the world through their lens when they were 4-H'ers. So what we're excited is that we make sure to continue to be current, and also that we use what we know as great successes and maybe deliver it in a way and communicate the programming in such a way that really ties into the passion and the excitement that inspires Generation Z.
Given all of the ways you're adapting and stuff, right now, how would you define what a 4-H club is as opposed to, say, Scouts or some other organization that young people could join?
When we look at the 4-H program, we have quite deliberately broken down. We know that 4-H in Nova Scotia looks different than 4-H in Saskatchewan or 4-H in Ontario, but there are some key items that come through regardless of where you are a 4-H'er. Things like skill mastery, things like a sense of belonging, that you're doing things hands-on, the learn to do by doing motto applies very much today. And so those common themes, whether you're doing a service club in Nova Scotia, a beef club in Saskatchewan, or maybe a cooking or life skills club in Ontario, those key things in terms of skill mastery and leadership development and hands-on activities are part of the secret sauce, you might say.
Now, one of the things that's really interesting, given the proclivity of the agricultural community to be sort of slanted towards male versus female, 4-H'ers are predominantly like 60% female. Can you talk a little bit about why that disparity?
I think it's twofold. I would say that, for one, we look at what a great inclusive and open program 4-H is. And so it's not surprising that all youth, whether male or female, are participating in the program. We know that it's entire families. So you, generally speaking, maybe all the siblings in a family are participating in the same 4-H club together. And the second part of that, I would say, ties a little bit back to the diversity in the programming that I spoke to before as well. So in the beginning of the 4-H program, at the early part of the 19th century, things maybe were a little bit more leaning towards the male side because it was largely agricultural, and maybe in those cases that females weren't as welcome. And as the generations slide and as the programming slides, we see that it's very much nearly 50-50, and as you mentioned this year, tilting a little bit more to the female side. So it makes us feel like the programming continues to be accessible, and we're grateful to have those kinds of results.
Are you hoping that over time the urban demographic, the Gen Z folks in the urban areas, are going to come to 4-H? Are you quite happy with the mix of rural, farming, urban that you've got now?
I think, to be honest, if every youth in Canada wanted to be a 4-H'er, I think that would be terrific. In my own personal experience, I got so much out of the 4-H program that has helped me in my adult life. And whether you're rural, urban, suburban, agricultural background or not, I think if you're excited about learning new skills and being on some hands-on learning, I think the 4-H program is a great fit for anyone who wants to be there.
That was Stephanie Nagelschmidt, an excellent example of the crop of citizens 4-H has produced. So, here we are at the end of this episode of Harris Smith Radio. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please consider subscribing to this podcast on Apple iTunes or in your favorite podcast player. And please, tell your friends and family. Got feedback? We'd love to hear it. You can email us at letters@harrismithmag.com. That URL, harrismithmag.com, is also where you can order subscriptions online. And you can find Harris Smith Magazine on selected newsstands across Canada. Until next time, for Harris Smith Radio, I'm Wayne McPhail. And also, until next time, remember these four words: make, grow, sustain, share. Tune in for the next episode of Harris Smith Radio.